I call the Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Monday, February 27th, 2017. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present: Senator Meyer, Senator Stedman, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Hughes, and Senator Wilikowski. I expect Senator Coghill along shortly. Thanks to Ann and Matt, who are helping us out today. Today, the committee will take up one item on its agenda, and that's Senate Bill 60. This is sponsored by the Rules Committee at the request of the governor. Alaska's fish and game laws are the focus of this particular bill. When a person is found guilty of seriously violating the law of hunting or fishing, there is, in addition to the criminal fine, an additional amount of money that can be levied. That levy is the restitution the judge can impose on the guilty person for depriving Alaska's people of a resource held in common. The principle is simple. Other Alaskans, in the present and future, will not get the opportunity to benefit from our constitutionally protected game if it's illegally taken from us. The restitution laws attempt to assign a monetary value and capture that lost opportunity. In addition, when a non-resident illegally claims a resident fish or game license, they're not only depriving Alaskans of the non-resident revenue they would have paid, Alaskans also do not see the matching federal funds that those higher licenses, license fees, would have leveraged. So Senate Bill 50 was introduced last year as Senate Bill 164 during the 29th legislature. It was during deliberations with the administration and members of this committee, as well as the Judiciary Committee, that several important provisions were considered regarding proper restitution and due process. That bill did not become law. Which is why the committee has Senate Bill 60 before it today. And, of course, Senator Meyer and Senator Wilikowski will review it again as it goes into Judiciary, as well as Senator Coghill. So with that, I will welcome Major Chastain of the Department of Public Safety to come forward. He's here in the room with us. And online, we have Department of Fish and Game Wildlife Director Bruce Dale, and Department of Law, let me make sure, Department of Law, there's Aaron Peterson is online from the Department of Law. So welcome, Major Chastain. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Bernard Chastain. I'm a major with the Alaska Wildlife Troopers, Department of Public Safety. I'm their deputy director. And what I'd like to do today is go through basically what this bill does to the committee and explain sectional analysis as we go through that. AWT is the primary enforcement agency for all fish and wildlife laws in the state. We're your enforcement arm. When the legislature passes a bill, boards of fish, board of game, commercial services board, we're the ones out there actually enforcing that law. You've already identified on the phone, we have Department of Law and Fish and Game as well for lifelines if we have questions that I can't answer. And so if it pleases the chair, I'd like to give a brief history of the bill, a brief overview of what it does, and walk through the sectional analysis.
Great. Thank you.
So as you stated, Senate Bill 60 was introduced last year in this committee and the House at the same time, and it moved through committee on both sides, House and Senate. Some amendments were made in that process, and as the bill died last year, what was introduced this year is how it died. So there are some amendments in there that were well thought out, and you'll see them. I'll explain those today as those come forward. So first off, what does this bill do? There's a couple main concepts. The first off is it allows a person who receives a citation for not having the appropriate sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license in their actual possession. It allows them to correct that citation if they had a previously purchased license prior to that by bringing it to any office of Department of Public Safety, just like a correctable citation for a traffic ticket. It also makes it unlawful for a person to obtain a sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license if the person has had their rights to engage in those activities revoked or suspended in this or another state, and I'll explain that as well. It increases some restitution amounts for unlawfully taking big game animals and increases strict liability commercial fishing fines for first, second, and third offenses, and I'll explain those. And it also creates an option of charging with a violation or a misdemeanor offense for most statutes contained in Title 16, 1605, and 1610, depending on the culpability of the offender. I'll explain that. And it also standardizes the penalties contained in these statutes. So that's basically the overview of the bill. So I will start with a sectional analysis. So, Madam Chair, Section 1 amends 1605.330A to include the word permit in addition to license and tag. And for purposes of clarifying the proper types of documentation a person must have in their actual possession when engaging in certain activities, it reorders the activities of trapping and fur dealing to exclude the latter from being a correctable citation. Under 1605.330, a person engaged in the activities listed in 1 through 5 of Section 1 must have in their actual possession a license, tag, or permit to legally engage in that activity. Section 1 reorders the activities into two separate categories. 1 and 2 are considered sport activities. 3, 4, and 5 are considered commercial activities. And the purpose for this is contained in Section 3, which I'll explain in a second. Section 2 amends 1605.330D to make it unlawful for a person to obtain a sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license if the person's rights to engage those activities is revoked or suspended. And you'll notice that what is added in this section is the words this or, and I'll explain that here. Section 2 amends it to make it unlawful for a person to purchase a license in this or another state if their license to hunt, fish, or trap has been revoked or suspended in this or another state. Currently, the statute directs that a person who applies for a sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license or other permit or tag issued under this section shall sign a statement that their right to obtain or exercise a privilege of this is not suspended or revoked in another state. Surprisingly, this statute does not include Alaska. This will change and align this statute with the intent of the law. Section 3. This section amends 1605.330 by adding three different subsections. The first subsection provides that a person charged with failing to have the appropriate sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license in their actual possession may not be convicted if the person produces no later than 30 days after the issuance of the citation a license previously issued to that individual that was valid at the time of the offense. It makes it an official correctable citation to not have your sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license in actual possession when engaged in that activity. Alaska Wildlife Troopers realize that people sometimes forget their license at home, in their car, or other locations. For many years, we have given unofficial correctable citations to most people in this situation. This section will give the Alaska Wildlife Troopers the ability to cite a person for not having their sport fishing, hunting, or trapping license in possession and give them a period of 30 days to bring it to any office, and it will be dismissed. Basically, the citation is dismissed if there's no, if that person had a valid license prior to that citation. If passed, it'll be very similar to a correctable citation issued for headlight requirements, proof of motor vehicle insurance, and other requirements. This section ensures that people engaging in the activity of sport fishing, hunting, or trapping have a license and allows for some leeway for getting that license at home.
Yes. Senator Stedman, question?
Yes, Madam Chairman. I'm not sure if we're going to kind of do questions as we go through the section or just go to the end.
Why don't we do it right as we go through?
You know, the last couple of years we had talked about this electronic format so we can take a picture of it with our cell phone or our iPad or whatever and have it with us. I was kind of curious on deer tags. If there's a way or there's been any thought, so those could be in electronic format also. I know I've had some challenges personally just swapping hunting clothes back and forth. I always remember to have the tags because you got to mark them when the deer's down and tag it. And in sequential order, we have six tags, we're at unit four. But I was just wondering if that is something that is available or is not available or what have you.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I'll answer the first part about enforcement, and we also have Department of Fish and Game Wildlife Conservation online that could probably answer the question about the tag piece. So enforcement-wise, right now the law requires, as you identified, that you validate the tags. One of the problems has been how do you validate electronically and basically make that so that it's not you can't go back on that validation. And so from enforcement standpoint, that's been a difficult hurdle to overcome of how to make that work. But I'd also throw that out to Wildlife Conservation Director Bruce Dale if he has any comments.
Mr. Dale, did you hear the question?
Yes, I did. My name is Bruce Dale. I'm the Director of Wildlife Conservation for the Department of Fish and Game. Through the chair, we have been exploring ways to provide applications for phones and devices that will can be used perhaps for licenses, for reporting, and validating those reports. We have a two parts going on. We have a regulations delivery survey going out to ask what kinds of things users want, and then we also have a an IT project developed to explore what kinds of things we can do with this, and you know, having it not have to be a written form and having it be validated some way so that the tag can be certified are things that we're looking into.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman? All right, thank you. Senator Hughes.
Yes, thank you. And the grace period, the 30 days that would be allowed, what happens if a fish is caught or game acquired? What happens is, does the person, hunter, the fisherman, get to take that during that 30-day period, or how are you handling that? Because, and what happens right now if they don't have the license on them?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, thank you for that question. So currently, right now, if they don't have a license on them, we ask a series of questions to determine if they do or do not have a license. Most of the time, we can figure that out if they actually purchase one or not. If we determine that they do not have a license, we'll issue them a citation. We'll also give them an option to bring that in, and unofficially, we've been correcting those citations, basically giving them the benefit of the doubt that they actually had one. If they have game or fish at that time, we can choose. If we think that they do not have a license at all and they're basically not telling us the truth, we'll seize that game or fish item. If we think that they do have a license or they can prove in some way that they do, they get to keep that game or fish item as long as it was legally taken.
Okay, follow up.
Sure. One second, though. For the record, that was Major Chastain just speaking. We have lots of male voices, obviously. Back to Senator Hughes. Follow-up question.
Thank you. So it sounds like it's pretty much going to be handled the same way it is as far as the taking or allowing them to keep it, just based on the officer's best judgment at the time. Is that correct?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that's correct.
Thank you.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. So just so I'm clear, fishing licenses, dip netting permits, king tags, you can just take a picture of it and then keep it on your phone, and if you're on the Kenai River and somebody comes and asks for your dip netting permit, for example, or your fishing license, you just show them that on your phone, and that's okay?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. So this bill would make it lawful to present a license in electronic form. Last year when we came before the committee, if you remember, Kevin Brooks was here as well, Fish and Game, and he talked about that the Department of Fish and Game is underway right now with a digital licensing program. Right now, there is no mechanism in place to display electronic license. So if this passed and Fish and Game implemented electronic license, that would be acceptable.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
So you can't take a picture of it, in other words.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. Right now, with the examples that you gave, like a dip net permit, for instance, there's requirements to record things on that dip net permit, and that's there's no mechanism right now that you can record that on electronically and be legal.
Gotcha. Okay. And then one other
follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
And this is an issue I brought up last year. If you're out in, let's say, Bethel, in your Bethel area, and you're hunting and you don't have your license, or you're fishing, and you know your license, and you're from Anchorage, let's say you're from the United States, do you have to return back to Bethel to show your license, or can you mail it in? Can you show it in Anchorage somewhere at the Fish and Game Department?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, it's a good question. Thank you. The answer is you can bring it to any office. You can email it. You can scan it. We have a lot of people that right now come to Anchorage to our front desk and show us a license. We make a photocopy of it. We scan it to the trooper in a different location where they issued the citation, and it's taken care of that way.
Good. Don't see any more questions. Oh, pardon me. Senator Von Imhoff.
How much time will this save you, do you think, over the long run? Because you're going to have to accept new people or people coming in, you're going to scan it, you're going to figure out where it needs to go. That's time. But is that little time compared to following up on going to the Nooshugak River or the Kenai River and finding people and citing them for not having their license?
Through the chair, Senator Von Inhofe, if I understand your question, you're asking if the time comparative to one or the other, and I honestly don't know, haven't considered how much time that would save or not save, but at this point, I don't think it'd be very much. It'd be pretty much the same. What this does is it allows for an official way to correct a citation, so that we can basically issue the citation, and it's then incumbent upon the person who doesn't have the license to produce it. Oftentimes, as you can imagine, we have people who say they have a license and they really don't. They haven't purchased a license, and so what it does is it gives us the ability to deal with those people, but it also gives us the ability to deal with people who truly forgot it in their car or at home, and it doesn't go on their record at all. It just goes away after they send that in.
All right, I'll let you proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So this Section 3 also has two subsections or two additional sections, G and H. G allows for actual possession to include electronic form, and we just talked about Alaska Department of Fish and Game desires to have a system of electronic licensing, and they're working on that system. So when that's implemented, this would allow for presentation in that form. And the last section states that any peace officer presented with electronic device under this section shall be immune from liability resulting from damage. And this section talks about holds that peace officers who inspect these electronic licenses in the field immune from liability if damage occurs to the device. Hunting, fishing, and trapping licenses are often inspected in adverse conditions, aboard boats in violent seas, while hands are contaminated with fish or game parts, or in remote locations. If something happens to this device in the short time the peace officer is inspecting that device, this section holds that agency immune. If the section is implemented, these resource users will have the ability to decide whether they want to present an electronic copy or a paper copy. That's their choice to present it. Often we have to look at things very carefully on the license, so that may require us to expand the license out or look on the iPad or something. And then if we're doing that in pouring rain and it gets wet, we have to balance what our liability is there.
Senator Wilkowski.
Just on that. I can imagine the paper documents that you get are often not in the greatest shape. I know I've gone dip netting down in the Kenai and put it in my chest waders, and you get some high waves that come in, and your whole wallet gets soaked, and your fishing license gets soaked. You should put it in a little baggie, I know, but what do you do in that situation? Someone presents you with a paper writing, and it's hardly legible. Is that a fine that results in that case?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, no, that's not. We're able to determine if they have a license. In fact, if it's the same year and it looks like it's, you know, came from the year and the right license, then of course we'll go with that. And we have the ability to look those up. Not always. We have to have internet service through Department of Fish and Game. So sometimes we don't have connectivity. We're not able to look those things up, but we can make sure that we know you have a license after some period of time.
Let you proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 4. Section 4 under AS 1605-430, Fish and Game Penalties, and this section removes the specific fine of $1,000 and penalties associated with the unclassified misdemeanor and replaces it with a Class A misdemeanor established under 1255. The goal of this and subsequent sections, which I'm going to talk about throughout the sectional here, is to standardize the penalties within Title 16 and create two separate options for charging. The first option for serious offenses will be charged with a Class A misdemeanor, and the second option for less serious offenses will be charged with a violation offense. These penalties will be aligned throughout AS 16 and follow the penalties outlined in AS 1255. Madam Chair, this is important because in regulation, we have the ability to reduce charges to violations. In statute, we currently do not. And why this works well is it gives the Alaska Wildlife Troopers and Department of Law the ability to decide what is most appropriate for this offense. And so in a situation where it's an offense, but it's really not that big of a deal, we can charge with a violation. In a more serious offense, we have the ability to charge with a Class A misdemeanor. And this will align these sections throughout statute for that ability. Section 5, related to Section 4, this will allow a new subsection and create, I'm sorry, this adds a new subsection and creates the ability to charge some offenses as violations that are currently only allowed to be charged as misdemeanors. It also addresses the Pittman-Robertson Act and federal matching dollars lost by the state of Alaska when the state is defrauded by a defendant who does not purchase the proper license or tag required by law to participate in a specific fishery or hunt. Section 5 of this bill creates two new subsections. Subsection C establishes that a person may be charged with the violation offense if there's no culpable mental state established. And subsection D provides the court with the ability to impose additional restitution to the state of Alaska equal to the amount of lost federal matching fund from the Pittman-Robertson, Johnson-Wallop, Barreau programs when the state is defrauded by a defendant who does not purchase the appropriate license or tag or claims residency when they are not a resident. The court decides to implement the additional restitution for the loss of federal funds, and the court will be instructed to deposit the restitution into the Fish and Game Fund. What this section does is in situations where people defraud the state of Alaska by claiming residency, or it's probably the best example, is when someone is not a resident of the state of Alaska and purchases a resident hunting license and gets a moose tag across the counter, when they actually should have purchased a non-resident hunting license and a non-resident locking tag, that money that is lost is not only the money that is indirect, but as you identified earlier, Madam Chair, it's a loss of federal matching funds to the state of Alaska. And so occasionally, judges will be able to, when they decide that's appropriate, they'll be able to impose that federal matching fund dollar to that defendant, and that money can be deposited into the Fish and Game Fund and making the state whole, basically, by the loss in revenue.
Senator Stidman.
Chairman, if we could, just for those watching at home, could you just go over the difference between a Class A misdemeanor and, you know, the different classes and what have you, so the public at home could get a feel for the severity of the implications as they step up from a citation to a different class of misdemeanor to more serious and more expensive violations?
Certainly. Through the chair, Senator Stedman, I'll start by giving a brief overview, and then I'll have Department of Law add in additional stuff so they can explain that. So a violation offense is a maximum $500 fine. There are restrictions that cannot be imposed on a violation offense. And then a Class A misdemeanor is a maximum of $10,000 fine. There are all kinds of restrictions that can be imposed on a Class A misdemeanor, things such as jail time, forfeitures, revocation of licenses, probation, that kind of stuff. And I would ask Department of Law to add other things for violation offenses that I may have forgot.
So would that be Aaron Peterson? Mr. Peterson, did you hear the question?
I did, Madam Chair. Thank you. And through the chair, Senator Stedman. So as Major Chastain pointed out, the maximum fine for a violation under Title 12 is $500. And along with being a violation, there can't be any jail time, and there are some other restrictions because it's what the court has referred to as a quasi-criminal offense. So while criminal procedure applies, it is not viewed necessarily as a crime. And part of the reason for that is the definition includes something that you could go to jail for. So when we're talking about a crime, we're talking about something that you could go to jail for, and that would be a misdemeanor in this case for the purposes of this bill. As you can see throughout the bill, there are several non-classified misdemeanors that have their own unique penalty ranges under this bill, those would be changed to Class A misdemeanors, which I think the major pointed out. They have a maximum penalty section set out in Title 12 also. That was recently modified under the Omnibus Crime Bill. I think the maximum fine now is $25,000 and a year in jail. Of course, you know, I would also point out that with respect to violations, some Title 16 offenses have their own violation penalties as far as financial penalties go, and you'll see that in the next section. But when it says violation here, in, for example, Section 5, it says guilty of a violation punishable as provided in AS 1255, which is the Code of Criminal Procedure, and, again, the maximum fine of $500.
Mr. Peterson, could you formally introduce yourself for the record?
Oh, yes, I'm very sorry. It's Aaron Peterson with the Department of Law.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Peterson? Senator Wilikowski.
So how are these handled right now, just as guilty of a misdemeanor? Are they handled as A or B misdemeanors?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, many of these offenses right now that the bill would seek to change to in Class A misdemeanor are currently non-classified misdemeanors, and that's, as you can see, currently, for example, Section 4, that offense would be punishable by a fine of not more than $1,000 and imprisonment for not more than 6 months, which is a fine range and a prison sentence range that doesn't correspond to a Class A or a Class B misdemeanor. So it's, again, a non-classified misdemeanor. And currently, the Department of Law and the Department of Public Safety don't have the ability to reduce to a violation if there's no culpable mental state, which is often, certainly sometimes, appropriate to do, and obviously this bill would remedy that.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
So if we pass this, the culpable mental state is knowing, I would assume. And so if you went out ice fishing on January 2nd and you forgot to buy your fishing license for that year, are you knowingly violating a law and you could go to jail for a year? Or would that, I mean, tell me how, walk me through how you would handle that.
Sure. To the chair, Senator Wilikowski, the current culpable mental state of a Title 16 offense is actually a modified negligence standard set by the Court of Appeals in State v. Rice, and it is new or should have known. So that's the current mental state for a misdemeanor. And so if the Department of Law can prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the person should have known that they should have known that they needed a fishing license on January 2nd, then it's, yeah, if that were an offense that fit under this, although not having a license, I'll come back to that, but that has a separate penalty provision as well. But in any event, if, you know, in a situation like that, that's sort of a good example, because in a situation like that, most rational observers could say, well, you know, this person had a license, they've been fishing a lot, and, you know, simply forgot. That sounds like a good thing to reduce to a violation. And it's sort of illustrative of the current problem, where there are a lot of offenses that simply don't have that ability to reduce to a violation. So, again, this bill would remedy that.
Follow-up, Senator Wilikowski.
So I'm looking at Section 4, and let's see, it says... So where it looks to me like you're just saying a person who violates AS 1605-330, for example, which is licenses, sport fishing license, hunting licenses, et cetera, is guilty of a Class A misdemeanor punishable as provided in AS 1255. Does 1250, are you saying 1255 gives you the ability to either treat it as a jail time offense or as a violation, or are you just saying that's prosecutorial discretion that allows you to do that?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, it is currently a non-classified misdemeanor. So if the state can prove that the person should have known, knew or should have known, then that would establish the mental state for a misdemeanor. It would be an A misdemeanor under this bill that is accurate. And the bill would give the ability to reduce it to a violation if this range of offenses that are contemplated in the bill, if there's no culpable mental state. And obviously that does lend itself somewhat to prosecutorial discretion, obviously. Any time there's a decision made about the charging level or the appropriate resolution level of charge, those things come into play. Not just the ability to prove it, but the appropriateness of the resolution. Absent any discretion, of course, every offense would have to go to trial to, you know, highest possible charge and let a jury decide and then let a judge sentence. That would be terribly inefficient. So sort of seeking out some efficiencies here, this bill would give the ability to reduce a charge below that which it would be currently charged at, and currently, again, with no ability to reduce it to a violation.
Just a final comment.
Senator Wilkowski, pause for 1 second. Major Chastain, did you want to attempt to answer the question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Wilkowski, I think I answer your question really quickly here. The Superior Court has seen fit to create a bail schedule. This is on the bail schedule. So it is actually a bail citation and not a misdemeanor.
Okay.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
Section 4, it says we're creating a Class A misdemeanor, but Section 5, we're saying we're giving the prosecutor the ability. It just seems to me a tremendous... I have always been reluctant to give prosecutors that much leeway to decide the fate of a person, whether they're going to go to jail for a year, whether they're going to pay a $50 fine. That's an awful lot of leeway. So I'm sure we'll take this up in judiciary in a lot more depth.
Senator Von Imhoff.
Okay. Thank you. I just hope that I get a little bit of clarification. So just to review, right now, if someone is caught without a fishing license, it is an unclassified misdemeanor with a current fine of up to $1,000 or by imprisonment for no more than 6 months or by both. What this bill may do is either go lessen it to a violation of no more than $500 or elevate it to a Class A misdemeanor that has all sorts of things attached to it. Based on what criteria to go up or down? Did I capture that correctly?
You're the chair, Senator Von Inhofe. I don't have my statute book in front of me. So the first answer to your question is, it is a bail offense. So it is removed. That offense of not having your license in possession is a bailable offense. That can be found in the court rules section.
And for the record, this is Major Chastain who is answering the question at the moment.
This is Major Chastain, Madam Chair. This doesn't have the bail schedule in it, but it is a bailable offense. It's a $200 citation for not having a sport fishing license in possession. And so this exact argument came up, and there's a series of bail violations that have been removed from statute. Because, so that they do not, they are not misdemeanors. They are, the court has decided, and the bail schedule committees have decided, it's more appropriate for these offenses to be listed as bail offenses and simply write a citation and be done with it than to make it a misdemeanor offense. So there's probably a couple hundred of those throughout statute and regulation that are bailable tickets and not classified under this section.
Senator Von Imhoff, further question?
No, thank you.
Other questions? Senator Hughes.
And this is changing the subject. Going to Section 5, the court having the ability to pay, order that restitution be paid, Can you give us an idea of the range of what those lost match dollars might amount to, what kind of restitution? And do you have any idea how much we've lost due to this, not having this on the books on an annual basis?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, that's another good question. So restitution can be as simple as that lost amount of money can be as simple as somebody who decides they're going to come up to Alaska and purchase a resident fishing license and get a dip net permit, and they don't qualify for residency. And the difference could be simply the cost of a resident license versus what they would have to buy as a non-resident license. But annually, we investigate major residency cases where people have been defrauding the state for many years. And in addition to dip net permits and king salmon stamps and bag limits for all kinds of stuff, they've shot sheep and brown bear and goats and all kinds of things over time. And those tend to add up. In fact, we've had several cases where on the state side, they've defrauded $30,000, $40,000. So the matching would be three times that, that they're basically defrauding the state. It is very lucrative for people to cheat on residency. People, Alaskans have the ability, because we're residents, to be able to get a lot of these tags and permits without cost or for very low cost. On the contrary, non-residents pay quite a bit more for those fees, and in fact they're restricted in a lot of the hunting, and in certain things like dip netting they can't even participate. So it's absolutely lucrative for them to try to cheat, and so the state loses quite a bit of money. I don't know how much, but a substantial amount of money.
Follow-up, Senator Hughes.
Just for clarification, when you said per person doing this series of fraud, $30,000 to $40,000 per person that's doing this in a year's time, and you might have how many people doing this?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, this may be one person that's been doing it for years. So what we have to look at is how if this person has been claiming residency, how many animals have they taken under that claim of residency over a period of time, as statute of limitations allow, basically what have they done to defraud the state? And what we find is typically these people are not only violating residency laws, but they're also getting PFD, and they're also doing a lot of other stuff. And these things tend to get lumped together in larger cases, and we end up prosecuting them through various means.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman.
I'm just kind of curious on the intent here. Is it to give you more flexibility and the prosecutors more flexibility to deal with the out-of-state violators that you just mentioned that could have multiple offenses for multiple years versus Alaska resident that maybe forgot to buy his fishing license or did a very minor technical error?
The chair, Senator Stedman, that's exactly the intent. The point here is not if someone did not have a fishing license to ask the judge to impose additional restitution on that person. In fact, as I explained before, not having a fishing license is a simple bail offense, and there's no ability for a judge to add that to it. These cases are when we would charge as a Class A misdemeanor, go before a judge and a jury, and have cases where the judge and the jury can decide whether this should be applied or not. Oftentimes, judges are looking for alternative ways to make the state whole, and this is one of those ways.
Further questions? I have one. So you clarified, of course, that an out-of-state resident couldn't dip net. How often does that happen that you find out-of-state folks that are out dip netting without a license?
Madam Chair, I don't have that number off the top of my head, but I can tell you it's pretty frequent. We come in contact with that pretty regularly during dip net season. Oftentimes, we don't catch up to them until maybe the winter time when we have a little bit of time to start investigating these cases, and we look to see who has obtained dip net permits, and we see some things on the dip net permits that may be clues as that they're not a resident, or we look at their license and find out that they're not a resident. Oftentimes those tend to lead to bigger things as we start investigating these cases. It's very difficult. We have no reason to believe that someone's not a resident when we're talking to them on the riverbank while they're dip netting. So it's pretty rare to catch them at that point, but oftentimes it's after the fact when we're able to look at some paperwork and verify that.
Thank you. All right, I think we're ready for Section 6.
Madam Chair, Section 6 addresses strict liability commercial fishing violations. Strict liability commercial fishing violations are not criminal offenses. This statute establishes a monetary value for first, second, and third time strict liability commercial fishing offenses within a 10-year period. These amounts are maximum amounts that a judge may impose. They're not the fine. They're the maximum that they could impose. And oftentimes, the fines are well below those maximums. The fine amounts in this section, I'm sorry, I just said that. The section raises the strict liability commercial fishing violation fines from amounts established in 1988 when this section was enacted to the same amount adjusted for inflation in 2016 dollars. So basically, if you look at number one, which goes from $3,000 to $6,000, in 1988, when that was enacted, it was $3,000. In today's dollars, it's $6,050. The only one that's different is Section 3, and went from $9,000 to $15,000, and that's because Section 3 was added at a later date in the legislature. Section 7, amend 1605-722 by adding a new subsection related to Section 6 and contained within 722. This section requires a court system to transmit notice of all convictions under this section to the Commercial Fisheries Entry Commission, or CFEC. Commercial fishermen are applied points similar to driver's licenses when a person is convicted of certain commercial fishing offenses. It's important that points applied to commercial fishing convictions be conveyed to the agency that's responsible for keeping track of the points that's applied to that individual. That's all this section does.
Senator Stedman, question.
Yes, Madam Chairman. I'm just kind of curious on the Section 6, the need to do the escalation. Like on the first conviction, do we have a estimate of the range of those fines on the first conviction? And see, 3,000 is a maximum, projected to go to 6. Then I have a follow-up.
Through the Chair, Senator Stedman, the fines vary depending on what fishery you're in and how competitive those fisheries are. In certain areas of the state, a typical fine might be $3,000 with $1,500 suspended for the first offense. And if that person is convicted, any fish that they have caught illegally belongs to the state of Alaska, so that fish is forfeited to the state. So in other areas of the state where it's more competitive, the fines have stayed pretty close to $3,000 to be applied, and of course that goes up with each subsequent offense. In addition to this, since these are not criminal offenses, we also have the ability of charging a Class A misdemeanor for serious commercial fishing violations, and we can apply those as needed. It's pretty rare that we charge a Class A misdemeanor for commercial fishing offense. Most of the time, it's because they've done something pretty wrong, and it's outside an area pretty far in Bristol Bay, way outside the lines, or some serious commercial fishing offense.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman?
Well, the concern I have, Madam Chairman, I don't know if taking a fine, like, for instance, the first one from 3 to 6,000 or the second one from 6 to 12, would be or would change anybody's behavior, because all the other issues that they face, loss of fish, potential other violations, adding to their points, seems to me that they're already hit pretty hard. Thinking back, we had we've seen fish violations, for instance, when they intentionally go into a bay, Red Bluff, or not Red Bluff, but Red Bay, south end of Baranoff, go into a closed fishery and actually hinder the fishery because they've aggressively fished it when it was closed, and closed for a reason. In those cases, I'm not so sure that jacking it up a few thousand dollars would prevent that. And then not only that, all the other penalties and costs that the person's going to be imposed on is such a severe deterrent that they've got a good chance of losing their boat even. So I'm not quite sure the need for it once we put the full gamut of the long arm of the law on the table. You know, and I've never, in years, being around the commercial fishing industry, ever thought the impression that they thought the penalties were, you know, light or so light that they could be ignored. For instance, on this one, if insaning, if they got their rings up late, would that fall into this category also? Maybe might need to explain what that is, but could you help me with that a little bit?
Madam Chair and Senator Stedman, so this is another one of those complicated question, complicated answer. There is a variety and a unlimited number of violations that could occur out there let's take commercial fishing specifically. In your area, in Sitka, we have the herring fishery that is a substantial commercial fishing opportunity. In that setting, we typically cite people for seconds early or seconds late because it is a substantial economic advantage for that person to drop their net early by a couple seconds. That is a major. Those fisheries are highly economic and highly competitive, and we have to be right there with the fishermen to make sure that they're not putting their net in early or coming out late. Other fisheries are not that competitive. They don't have as much money at stake. Some of the more tame fisheries are what we call kind of mom and pop fisheries. You know, they have folks that just want to try to make a living at trolling for kings, and they're happy with just being out on the boat. It varies greatly, and we have to look at that very carefully as to what is it that they're doing, what illegal activity is taking place, what's their economic advantage. There's multiple layers in that. As we cite the person and give it to the Department of Law, there's multiple layers of review to make sure that we're applying that in the appropriate way. And so I can't tell you, based upon your question about if someone has their rings up late, what that means, but it could mean a citation. It could mean that we're going to give them a warning. It just depends on the scenario.
Clarify that. I'm sure.
Yes, clarification, Senator Stedman.
Kind of the inverse of setting early. You know, like you'd mentioned, there's, and I think you're right on point, that seconds in the sacro fishery is substantial advantage and economic advantage, time advantage, just advantage, period. Getting the rings up late, normally that's the cutoff time. You have to have your rings on deck or at the bottom of the seine, and you got to purse up and get them up, and you could have a hang-up or a tide or what have you, or slow crew. I mean, multiple things that slow you down, and a lot of times those rings are on deck seconds before the close, as I'm sure that the timing of that is watched very close, not only by the officers involved, but also by the other fishermen involved. And they'll watch each other, and the Coast Guard, and that fisheries that we just referenced, there's even ships bumping into each other. But I guess it comes back to the, you know, I recognize a dollar increase to the Treasury, but I don't think it would deter the activity. I think the rest of the whole package is scary enough. I think that fella in South Baranoff, I think his boat went up to auction, if I remember right, on the fishing in Red Bay, when it shouldn't have been, and impacted the fishery for multiple seasons. It wasn't just a minor drift over the line, you know, inadvertent oversight because you gauged the tide and wind wrong or what have you. But anyway, we can go on, Madam Chairman. I'm just not sure that if we're, you know, that we don't have enough deterrence already in the system. You know, some of the guys actually go out of business. The impact is severe. And the ability that we have to monitor the time elements with helicopters and airplanes and photography and everything else. It's pretty structured.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. I think we're ready to move on to Section 8.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Major Chastain. Section 8 amends 1605.782 and removes the penalty section from A, which cleans up the subsection and makes it clearer. And it makes it clear that a person may not take a brown or grizzly bear within a half mile of a solid waste disposal facility. And these next sections that I'm going to talk about all basically align what I talked about earlier, violations and misdemeanors, and they create that alignment within Title 16. Section 9, related to Section 8, removes the unnecessary reference in Section A and maintains the additional penalties of a fine failing to salvage the hide in the skull of a brown bear taken within a half mile of a solid waste disposal facility. Section 10, also related to Section 8, amends 1605.782 and adds two new subsections that establish the penalties as Class A misdemeanors for a criminal offense, and they provide the additional option of charging a person with a violation when appropriate. Section 11, 1605.783, which is same-day airborne hunting. This section removes the specific fines and penalties associated with an unclassified misdemeanor and replaces it with a Class A misdemeanor for consistency in penalties. Section 12, which is the prohibition for hunting adjacent to the highway between the Yukon River and Arctic Ocean. This section amends B and adds that the penalties for this violation of the section is a Class A misdemeanor, punishable by 1255. And Section 13, related to Section 12, adds a subsection which allows for charging the violation when appropriate. Section 14, which is obstruction or hindrance of lawful fishing, hunting, or trapping. This section adds a new subsection to allow for charging some offenses as a violation when there's no culpable mental state. Section 15, which is the waste of salmon statute. This section removes the specific fines and penalties associated with unclassified misdemeanor and replaces it with a Class A misdemeanor. Section 16 is a new subsection and provides for charging offenses committed between 1605.871 and 1605.896 as violation offense, punishable by 1255.
Thank you. Major, if you could pause for 1 second. Senator Stedman had a question.
Yeah, back on Section C, line 27 on page 4.
Section 15?
Yes. We're getting into, I think that's what we refer to, maybe, and Mr. But you mentioned on like salmon fishing. If does that get involved in the wanton waste if someone takes a salmon and cuts it up for halibut bait? Not that any of my friends ever do that.
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. So waste of salmon could be charged as that. Most of the time it's charged when large amounts of fish are wasted. So we've charged them before when we find commercial fishermen that are stripping roe and wasting fish. We charge them for processors when they let fish rot on the docks. We've charged them with usually we find a lesser offense that we can charge somebody for that type of thing. So it's there's available offense that applies for that situation you just described.
Okay.
Yes,
sir.
Madam Chair, this is Major Chastain. I believe I was on Section 17.
Correct.
Section 17, penalty for violations, is amended to provide consistency in the penalties as provided in AS 1255 and provides an exemption for a new subsection under Section C, which I'm going to talk about here in just a second. In 925B, this subsection provides for restitution amounts that the court may impose, and that's important, may impose, for illegally taken big game animals in Alaska. This section increases the restitution amounts by at least 50% that a person convicted of unlawfully taking a big game may have to pay the state if the judge chooses to implement restitution. Alaska's game belongs to all of us collectively. When a big game animal is unlawfully taken, it defrauds the state of the value of the animal to its citizens. This value varies greatly depending on the species of the animal, the location of the take, the social value of the animal, the economic value of the animal, and the food source value to the people of the state. These restitution values may be imposed by the court if the case warrants applying restitution. In most cases, it does not make the state whole for the loss of the animal, but it helps pay the state back for the illegal take. These restitution amounts were enacted in 1984 and have gone untouched since then. The original bill submitted in the 2016 legislature increased restitution amounts by 50% from the base amounts in statute. Some of these amounts were changed in committees as the bill moved through the legislature last year. This version of the bill reflects the changes that were made in those committees. Some animals, like moose, went up in total restitution by 150%.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. So I want to just make sure I understand this. Someone's out hunting. They take a moose. They and then they realize it's maybe 3 inches, a little bit short from a legal moose. They pack it. They take it out 50 miles or however. They turn it over to the state fish and game. Under C, they will not have to pay the fine or restitution.
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, that's a good question. Under C, the court would not be able to charge the restitution amount. So currently, the way that works is if someone turns themselves in voluntarily, packs the meat out, says, "Hey, I screwed up. I shot the wrong animal or the wrong size." Brings everything in, antlers, meat, and good condition. They're charged with a violation offense. They're typically the typical fine, and I know this because I just looked back the last 3 or 4 years. The typical fine is about $300. They get a $300 ticket. They don't lose their hunting license. They don't lose any equipment. They lose the animal because the animal is taken illegally, but that's it. They only get a small fine and they walk away.
Under
follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
Under this, and that's a new section that we're adding. So under current law, you're not actually allowed to do that, or the courts are making an exception, or how are they dealing with that currently?
Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, under current law, there are magistrates who occasionally impose restitution on those cases. In fact, last year, there were 4 cases out of all of them that magistrates decided to impose that for some reason, or judges. What this would do, if this passes, is it would tell magistrates and judges that you cannot impose restitution for people who voluntarily turn themselves in.
Yeah. Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
Just on the word may, it says defendant may not be ordered. Is that discretionary, or is that, maybe that's a question for law. It's a little bit confusing to me to see a may not. Do you know, or maybe somebody from law, Madam Chair? The question is that ordering the court to not require you to pay restitution, or is that giving the court the option to not require you to pay restitution?
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. Mr. Peterson, did you hear the question?
I did. Thank you, Madam Chair. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski, this is Aaron Peterson for the record. That would not be read as a permissive may, that the court may or may not, but when the legislature says the defendant may not be ordered to do something, in this case pay restitution, then that is tantamount to the legislature telling the court that they shall not do it. I know that legislation is generally drawn up with this language, but it was actually recently, I don't have the case name on the top of my head, but a judge did interpret very similar language here in Anchorage to mean that since it says may, that may also mean may not. And the Court of Appeals reversed that order. Unfortunately, I don't have the name off the top of my head, but that the answer is that it could just as easily read shall not be ordered.
Senator Wilkowski.
Probably save you a court challenge because you know that will be challenged.
Thank you. Senator Von Imhoff, question. And who would your question be for? Major Chastain?
Yes. So, again, someone volunteers to return their animal because they realize they did it incorrectly or illegally. Is there a way to, I guess, evaluate whether it was an honest mistake? What comes to mind is Section 11, same-day airborne hunting. And it seems to me that that's relatively a well-known fact. You do not hunt and shoot the same day. But I suspect that there are people that do that. So can someone claim mea culpa and then just give back the moose?
Through the chair, Senator Von Inhofe. So typically, on average, as I looked at this before I came down here, we have about 130 cases where there's self-turn-in animals each year across the state. Those cases are almost always moose and sheep. Those are the cases where we get. So the typical self-turn-in case is someone thinks the moose is 50 inches or thinks it has three brow tines and shoots an animal and makes a mistake, and they do the right thing. They salvage the animal, they bring it from the field, and they make a very difficult phone call to enforcement and say, I screwed up. And so it's our belief that we reward them in that scenario for calling us up and saying and bringing in the animal. That's the incentive for them to do that. Otherwise, they would just try to sneak it home or you know, not bring it in. In the case that you identified, same day airborne, that's a whole separate it's a whole separate crime of same day airborne.
Okay. Good. All right. I think we are. Well, we've already discussed Section 18. But if you have anything to add on that.
I have one thing, Madam Chair. This is Major Chastain again. Section 18 was actually an amendment that Senator Coghill last year helped craft, and so we fully support that that section.
Senator Wilkowski.
On Section 18, I think it's a good section. Do you ever have issues with multiple people who shoot wrong size moose multiple times, and is that a concern that you have at all?
The Chair, Senator Wilkowski, we do have that. Occasionally people will take an illegal animal and turn themselves in, and then the next year they'll go out and they'll do the same thing, shoot an illegal animal and turn themselves in. And so what we do currently is we discuss that with the Department of Law and how we're gonna proceed with prosecution. At some point that self-turn-in will cease to be able to happen, because then they can't continue to do that each year.
Follow-up, Senator Wilkowski.
Under the statute, as I read it, there's no limitation. I mean, you can just keep doing it, as I read it, unless I'm missing something. Is that maybe law sees something differently?
Major, should we ask Mr. Peterson?
Through the chair, Madam Chair, Senator Wilkowski. So under this section, the way it reads now is that someone who does this and turns in the animal would not be charged restitution. We still have the ability to charge them as a violation or as a misdemeanor, depending on how we want to do that. So if we chose, because the person, let's say, for 3 years straight did the same thing, we have that ability to charge it as a misdemeanor.
Senator Senator Hughes.
Just a comment. After that second time, do you suggest they get their eyes checked?
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is Major Chastain. Section 19 adds a definition to this section. The paragraph defines the term electronic form as it pertains to Section 3 of this bill. If you remember, we talked about electronic forms and if that is implemented by Department of Fish and Game. And it provides for a display of a license or image on an electronic device such as a mobile telephone, tablet, or computer that will satisfy the display of fishing and hunting licenses. The next sections I'm going to take in one block, Sections 20 through 27, all standardize penalties and create the ability to charge either misdemeanor or violation. Those basically are the same thing that we just talked about. Section 28 amends the uncodified law of Alaska to make it clear that the act applies to offenses that occur after the effective date of the act. And Section 29 provides for an effective date of July 1st, 2017. Madam Chair, that concludes my presentation.
Thank you, Major. Further questions? Senator Hughes.
Yes, I didn't have the privilege of hearing this bill last session. I'm just wondering, it didn't make it through the process. Were there particular problems, or was it just a matter of time and the session was coming to a close? Can you speak to that?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I think it was a combination of a lot of that. It went through the House and the Senate at the same time. There were amendments being made on both sides, and then I think time just ran out. That's my opinion.
Further follow-up, Senator Hughes.
So as far as from sportsmen's groups and folks like that, have they expressed any problems or concerns or opposition?
Through the chair, Senator Hughes, I've had last year there was a few people that called in that had some concerns. One person in particular, actually, I spoke to shortly after the presentation last year, answered his questions, and he was in support of the bill.
Thank you.
Senator Stedman.
We could just back up a little bit. When we're talking about identification of animals, moose in particular. Could you maybe talk a little bit about what you found in dealing with the Thomas Bay area and trying to identify the moose in that area? That's by outside of Petersburg. Just to give some of the members here the field challenges, the feeling for the field challenges that the hunters face. And then I have a follow-up question.
Good Chair, Senator Stedman. This is Major Chastain for the record. And my background, to give you a little background, I was stationed in Ketchikan as a sergeant in the charge of the Petersburg area, Wrangell, Prince of Wales Island, so I have a little knowledge of the area down there. I suspect you're asking about moose particularly. Each year we get a wide range of moose that are shot in that area with different antler configurations, and those antler configurations don't really comply with the rest of the state because there are different subspecies of moose. I'm certainly not a biologist, but I know I've talked with the Department of Fish and Game multiple times, and Director Bruce Dale could talk about this, I'm sure, but typically what we find is these antlers are a lot different than your typical moose antlers, and they have strange projections and different configurations that are tough to determine sometimes what's legal and what's not legal. And so oftentimes we find antlers that may be broken or have hidden points that we don't really even see until they bring the antlers in. But it's not unlike most of the moose in southeast Alaska, that they're just a strange, you know, looking animal as far as antlers.
So the
follow-up, Senator Stedman.
Yeah, so these moose that are in, that are taken that are out of compliance with the regs in are turned in to, whatever group in town, I guess, is going to get them to cut them up and feed the people and stuff. But have you found that the hunters are pretty responsive to working with the troopers in identifying and trying to comply with the regs and good about getting a hold of the troopers to check questionable animals in the area? Or?
Through the chair, Senator Stedman. My experience has been that the hunters in that area have been pretty responsive to helping out. There was a period of time where there were a lot of illegal animals being taken. And in one period of time, there was a lot of animals that were intentionally being broken so that they would turn into a spike or a fork. And a regulation was created about a broken antler regulation. And I happen to know from one year we went from over 30 cases of broken antlered moose to the next year after that regulation was created to one. So we know that it did affect that. But we also know that Southeast Alaska and that moose population, it can't be compared to interior for the size of moose and the type of moose that they're getting.
Follow-up, Senator Sibin.
And one last comment. The vast majority of the hunters I know get pretty much teased pretty bad, sometimes ridiculed by their buddies or other people in town when they inadvertently shoot one that's out of compliance, in particular if they do it more than once. I mean, it's not something that the guys are very proud of, I'll assure you that. And it's a lot of work, Madam Chairman, to get a game animal out of the woods and deliver it to the community, and plus your friends aren't going to forget it. The long arm of the law will forget it a lot sooner than your buddies will.
Thank you, Senator Stidman. Any other questions for Major Chastain or the team that is online? I will thank Aaron Peterson, Department of Law, Director Dale, and Natalie Weber, who is also online from Department of Fish and Game. Looks like no other questions. Carol Petreborg is also here with you. Is that right, Major? In the room? Yes, great. Thanks for being here today. And Major, I just, you know, it's not too often that we get a state trooper before us. I understand that you're with the Fish and Wildlife Division, but regardless, just wanted to thank you for your service. Our state troopers do great work, and I just want to thank you for that. So, with no further questions, that concludes our meeting for today. On Wednesday, which is March 1st, is our next meeting. We're going to take up this bill again, including public comment. In addition, we're going to hear Senate Bill 44 by Senator Gardner. So at this time, we'll adjourn. The time is 4:40 p.m.